All right, welcome everyone to another deep dive. You know how this works. You send us some sources and we really dig into them.
That's right. Take a close look and try to pull out the important stuff, the things that really make you think.
And this time around, we're looking at a legal case, McWhorter v. State. It's a 1953 decision from the Alabama Court of Appeals.
Yeah, and this one is a real window into the past, a very specific time and place.
We've got a few things to work with here, some guidance on how to approach the case, some perplexity analysis, and of course, a standard legal brief.
So yeah, we have the case itself and then some ways of kind of breaking it down.
Right. And our goal here is to, to understand the big legal and social issues at play in this case. Why is this case still important? Why are we still talking about it?
And we want to make sure we explain those issues clearly,
Yeah.
without getting bogged down in all the legal jargon.
So let's set the stage first. We're in Alabama, 1950s.
Deep South, Jim Crow era.
Racial segregation is the law of the land.
And it's not just the law. It's woven into the fabric of everyday life, influences social customs and norms in a huge way.
Absolutely. And this context is crucial for understanding the court's decision in this case.
Right, the backdrop is everything.
Now, the case involves a black man, Mr. McWhorter, who was charged with attempted assault with intent to rape.
A very serious charge.
So can you walk us through what happened? What are the basic facts of this case?
Okay, so picture this. It's a summer evening, June 29th, 1951, in Atmore, Alabama. Mrs. Ted Allen, a white woman, she's walking home from a diner. She's with her children and a neighbor's child.
So pretty normal evening, walking home.
Right, everyday life. But then she notices McWhorter, a black man, sitting in a parked truck. As she walks by, he says something to her, but she can't hear it clearly.
Oh, so already we're seeing the racial dynamics start to play a role.
Absolutely. And it escalates from there. McWhorter gets out of his truck and starts following her on foot. Mrs. Allen, she's scared, understandably so, and she runs to a friend's house for safety.
Okay, so that's a pretty scary situation, but where does the attempted assault charge come in? What leads to that?
Right. Well, McWhorter is arrested, and according to law enforcement officials who testified, he confessed to planning to, and I quote, "get a white woman that night."
Whoa, that's a pretty incriminating statement.
It is, but it's important to note that during the trial, McWhorter actually denies making this confession. His defense is that he was in that area looking for a friend who lived in what was called the Front, a predominantly black neighborhood.
So you have these two very different accounts of what McWhorter was doing there and what his intentions might have been.
Right, and that conflict becomes a big part of the case.
So this brings us to the central question that the court had to grapple with. Did the prosecution present enough evidence to prove McWhorter intended to commit assault with a specific intent to rape Mrs. Allen?
Exactly. And it's important to understand that this central legal question is intertwined with another big question. How did the racial climate of that time, the deeply ingrained social customs, how do they factor into determining intent?
Yeah, you can't really separate those two things in this case, can you?
No, you can't. So how did the court reason through all of this? Well, Judge Price, who wrote the majority opinion, focused on two main points. First, he pointed to the alleged confession, that statement about wanting to get a white woman.
Okay, and what was the second point?
The second point focused on the actions of McWhorter. Mrs. Allen and other witnesses described him following her and then lingering near her house for about 30 minutes.
Right, following and lingering. And the court took that as further evidence of intent.
Exactly. And it's here, though, where the case takes a turn that's really jarring when we view it from a modern perspective. The court went beyond just the confession and the actions.
What do you mean?
They explicitly said, and I'm quoting here, that social conditions and customs founded upon racial differences were admissible for the jury to consider.
Well, hold on. They're basically saying that in 1950s Alabama, the fact that a black man was following a white woman could be used to infer criminal intent.
Sadly, yes. They're saying it's okay for the jury to factor in those racial dynamics.
That's pretty disturbing.
It really is, and it raises a lot of questions about how much progress we've actually made when it comes to racial bias in the legal system.
Right. So how did they then fit those facts, especially the intent part, into the legal definition of attempted assault? What are the elements of that charge?
So generally, attempted assault with intent to rape, it requires two things. One, there has to be evidence of a specific intent to commit rape by force, meaning the accused intended to have non-consensual sexual intercourse and plan to use force or the threat of force to do so.
Okay, so that's the intent part. And what about the second element?
The second element is what's called a substantial step. It's not enough to just think about committing a crime or even to prepare for it. You have to take a concrete step towards actually doing it.
So how did the court say McWhorter met those two parts of the legal test?
Well, for the intent part, they pointed to his alleged confession, that statement about getting a white woman. They interpreted that as showing a specific intent to commit rape.
Okay, and how did they argue he took a substantial step towards actually doing it?
Well, that's where the following and lingering come in. The court said that those actions, especially when viewed through the lens of the racial and social context they had already outlined, those actions were more than mere preparation. They were concrete steps towards carrying out the intended crime.
And this is exactly where legal scholars raise huge red flags about the case, right? This whole idea of using racial context to determine intent.
Yes. Modern critiques of McWhorter v. State focus heavily on that point. They say the court's reasoning is a blatant example of racial bias tainting the legal process.
Like, they're essentially saying McWhorter was guilty because he was a black man in a segregated society.
And the argument is that if you remove the racial element, if you're just looking at those actions, the following and lingering, in a vacuum, they might not be enough to establish the intent to commit rape.
So basically, they're saying race became the deciding factor.
Exactly. It's a chilling thought.
Let's dig into some of the specifics a bit more. You mentioned earlier a rule about needing evidence to back up a confession. What was that all about?
Yeah, so in Alabama at that time, there was something called the confession corroboration rule. Basically, a confession on its own wasn't enough to convict someone. There had to be independent evidence to back it up, to corroborate it.
That makes sense. You don't want to just rely on a confession, especially if it's potentially coerced or unreliable.
Right. And in McWhorter's case, the court said that his actions following Mrs. Allen and lingering served as corroboration for the confession.
But critics argue that those actions, without the added weight of the racial bias, are pretty ambiguous.
Exactly. They could be interpreted in a number of ways. It really shows how easily that corroboration can be twisted to fit a narrative.
So how does the term racialized intent connect to all of this? What does that mean specifically in this case?
In this case, racialized intent refers to the court's explicit decision to link McWhorter's race, being black, with the assumption that he intended to rape a white woman. They said it was okay for the jury to use those racial dynamics, those social taboos of the time, as evidence of intent.
So it wasn't just about what he did, but who he was.
Sadly, yes. And it's a stark example of how racial prejudice can be embedded in the legal system itself.
Which then leads to the question of, you know, where's the line between attempted assault and just preparing to do something? Would those same actions, the following and lingering, automatically be seen as a substantial step towards rape in a different context?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If you take away the racial element and the questionable confession, would McWhorter's actions still be enough to convict him? It's really debatable.
Right. In a different environment, those actions might just be seen as creepy or inappropriate, not necessarily criminal.
And that really highlights how deeply ingrained societal biases can shape the application of the law, even when the law is supposed to be objective.
This deep dive has been eye-opening, to say the least. What are the key takeaways from McWhorter v. State that we should really remember?
Okay, well, first, this case shows us that intent, which is a crucial element in many crimes, can be inferred from the circumstances surrounding an act. But, and this is a huge but, those circumstances can be heavily skewed by societal biases.
Like racial prejudice in this case.
Exactly. Second, the case highlights the need for corroborating evidence when dealing with confessions, but it also reveals how easily that corroboration can be manipulated or influenced by existing biases.
Right. It's not a foolproof safeguard.
No, it's not. And finally, and this is really important for everyone listening, McWhorter v. State serves as a potent reminder that we need to be constantly scrutinizing how societal biases, even unconscious ones, can creep into legal reasoning.
And that those biases can affect legal outcomes.
Even when seemingly objective legal standards are being applied.
It's clear that McWhorter v. State is more than just a case about an attempted assault back in the 50s. It's a stark illustration of how deeply rooted biases can warp the law and result in profound injustices.
It forces us to acknowledge a difficult truth. Legal principles, in practice, are not always immune to the prejudices of the society they operate within.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? How might implicit biases, even if they're not openly acknowledged, be shaping the way laws are interpreted and applied today? It's a tough question, but it's one we all need to be asking ourselves.
I agree. It's a question we can't afford to ignore. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. It's been quite a journey.
Indeed, it has.